And I have two other important announcements. Birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Donnie. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, who left the rackets out? Donnie, Rabbi Olson is trying to speak. No, by all means, cut it right now.
Is that a click?
Forget it. Can we just do this next week?
Okay.
Everyone just
Okay, in case you're wondering, it's not every week we do this. Levy, next, not even every week we do this. It just happens. Okay, two important announcements are one for Shona Bet.
Yeah.
Is
represent this table.
Is well, the one is really for, well, it's related to everybody. First of all, I didn't mention this morning. I should have mentioned this morning that Rav Judah Michel is coming to on Thursday night.
Yeah.
He'll be here. Thank you. He'll be here Thursday night at 7 o'clock during dinner. He's going to be talking about opportunities for working this summer in Camp Hask.
Yeah. Moshe Bob.
So if you don't. If you've never, most of you probably heard about Rav Judah Michel. He's quite a well-known figure in the world of Jewish education. He's the director of Camp Hask. He's going to talk about Camp Hask. Even if something right now, it seems like such a crazy thing, Camp Hask is not for me. I suggest you go to hear him, just to hear him, and just to open up yourself to that possibility. Any of the guys here that have gone to Camp Hask, a lot of them, thought themselves, and we thought ourselves as well, that there's no way they're going to survive in Camp Hask.
Is anyone
maybe
here?
One of those guys that we thought?
Yeah.
Anyways, but it's worth to hear him and to hear about what Camp Hask is about. Related to that, this is more for Shana Bet guys, is that he is organizing a trip to the Ukraine. Right after Rosh Chodesh Nisan, it's that he's going to be running together with Rav David L. Weinberg, and it's open to Shana Bet and above to Ukraine. He'll be bringing flyers about it, and if we get a good response from the yeshiva, maybe I'll go along as well. That's as far as Ukraine goes. For the more focus on the Shana Aleph guys, is tomorrow I'll be handing out. Information about our trip to Poland. I think most of you are aware that the yeshiva organizes a trip to Poland run by ourselves. The rebbeim in the yeshiva run this trip. It's a fantastic trip. Ask any of the Shana Bet guys who went last year how important it is for you to go on this trip. The little caveat this year, we're doing something a little bit differently, is that we're going after Pesach. Which means that if you or your parents are organizing flights for you to go home for Pesach, quote unquote home for Pesach, then you should consider the return ticket to return back to Israel in time, and you'll see the dates tomorrow, in time to get to meet that trip or to get back here in order to get that trip. If you don't get back before Shabbos, after Pesach, you won't be able to join the trip. You have to be here before Shabbos. Sunday morning, 6 a.m. is a flight to Warsaw. We're going for 5 days. We got an excellent price. It's about $300 cheaper than it was last year, because we're not going as long as they did last year. There is, related to that, and possibly related to Ukraine also, I never made a formal announcement about it. Some of the Shalaf guys have asked me about it. That is, we have a program here in Yeshiva called Masmidim program, which basically awards a dollar for every hour that you learn overtime during the break time between 1 and 3, before davening, after 10 o'clock at night, on Fridays, any time you put on Fridays, except for Shanabet, who have Seder on Friday, but any Shanav guy who learns on Fridays, on Shabbos, this Shabbos is in Shabbos, any time you spend learning on Shabbos, counts towards that. And every dollar you earn, every hour you learn, is every dollar you earn, and that can be used towards Poland trip or towards the purchase of Sfarim. We have a donor in the yeshiva who has generously given tens of thousands of dollars over the last number of years towards this. It's a fantastic investment for him because he's encouraging more learning, and you're using the money to just do more learning on Poland or in Poland, and then buying Sfarim. So we're very happy that we can offer this, and it's worthwhile investment to consider. You have till May to go to Poland, so it's going to help you. The trip is going to cost $1,575. So you can knock off a few hundred dollars by taking advantage of the Masminim hours. Okay, that's as far as the announcements go. Okay, last week I meant excuse me. Last week I mentioned, which relates to Poland, is that besides what I do here, I also guide groups in Poland. But the truth is, that's not all I do, and it's not about me. But I tried my hand at waitering. Not recently. When I was like, I guess 15 or 16 years old or so, and we were eating at the King David restaurant on Central Avenue, Olav HaShalom. King David restaurant was around for many, many years, and no one could understand how they stayed in business because nobody ate there. It could be related to the experience that I had about 20 some odd years ago, 30 years ago almost. I was eating innocently with my family. It was like an early dinner on a Sunday, and the restaurant was very busy. I guess somebody didn't show up, one of the waiters didn't show up, and we knew the owners of the restaurant, and they asked me if I'd be willing to waiter for the rest of the evening. Told me you can make a lot of money in tips, whatever. Those days, as today, I could use the money. So I agreed to do it. For some reason, they didn't ask me back after that one evening. Maybe they thought I was too interested in the tips. Maybe also related to some of the things that happened, which I'll share with you. I was coming back from the kitchen, carrying a couple of plates to one of the tables I was serving, and I see the manager carrying a plate with a steak that looked pretty red. And he walks past me and he looks at me and he says, "Didn't you hear the man say to you, 'Well done'?" And I said to him, "Well, you know, I appreciate the compliment, but I would prefer like a bigger tip." After that, the guy calls me over. And he says, "Hey waiter, can I get a refill of the water?" So I said to him, "I know we all look alike, you know, but my name is actually Michael, and I collect stamps. I enjoy long walks on the beach, and writing and reading poetry. But you know, Walter's your waiter, and I'll tell him to come over to you and help you with the water." Didn't go over so well. So they didn't ask me back, but it didn't deter me from trying my hand at it one more time. Actually, I was living in Israel, and I was actually in the kollel at the time, in the YU kollel upstairs, living here on the campus. And I had some time in the summer, so I figured, I need some money, I'll make some money waitering. So there's a restaurant here in Israel in the Elon Tower. I don't know if you know what the Elon Tower is. It's on King George, used to be one of the taller buildings in Israel. Now it's not so tall. It was 12 stories, and on the 12th floor they had a restaurant. So it was similar to Burger's Bar, Waffle Bar, but they didn't serve burgers or waffles. They just had a bar. So this guy is sitting there, and he's had a few already. Another guy comes down. Joe, you're recording this? It's a good one, this one. So the guy comes, sits down next to him. The guy has already had a few, and he orders a drink. And then they start talking about the wind tunnels in Jerusalem and the wind currents and so on and so forth. And the guy who just came turns to the other guy who's had a few drinks already, and he said, "I don't. What are you talking about to me? A wind current? What is the big deal? Who cares about wind currents?" He goes, "Yeah, you want to see why it's significant?" He goes, "Yeah." So the guy, he opens a window on 12th floor, and he basically jumps out of the window, does like a pirouette out of there, and then he comes back in. And then the guy sits down and goes, "Wow, that was really cool. Wow, you see the wind current, see the Jerusalem." So the guy who had just come in, he has a few drinks, and he says, "You know what, I'm going to try it." And he opens the window, jumps out. It was a mess. 12 floors, mess. So I turn to the first guy and I say, "Superman, you really mean when you're drunk." Superman? Get it?
You meant it?
Yeah. In those days, smoking was a problem. Today you go to a restaurant, nobody's allowed to smoke in restaurants. In those days, back in the good old days, people would smoke in restaurants, public places. It was allowed. I don't know if you even remember. You're old enough to remember that you could smoke. You used to be able to smoke in public places. But one of the things that a waiter had to do often is that when somebody was annoyed with smoke, they would call over the waiter, and they would say, "Can you tell the other table to stop smoking? Tell them to put it out." So you had to come up with sort of like, because you want a tip from both of them, right? So you want to sort of come up with like creative ways of telling the guy to stop smoking. So so I said to one guy, I said, "Aren't you worried that you're going to kill yourself by actively smoking?" He says, "No, it's worth it because I'm killing my wife from the passive smoke. It's worth it for me." The other guy tried a different approach. Said, "Think of all the money you'll save by quitting." And he said, "What do you mean? I'm going to live longer. I won't be saving any money. I'm going to have to more life years to live." The other guy said to him, "Doctors—they basically come to the conclusion. The scientists—they've said that smoking is with the families. Smoking is cigarettes. Cigarettes are dangerous to children." So he said, "You know what? You're right. I'll bring an ashtray. I'll start using an ashtray from now on." Okay. Let's go straight to learning. Skip the jokes. You have this week's parsha. Some of the most fundamental issues that arise in regards to going out of Eretz Yisrael. Parsha begins, "Vayetze Yaakov mibe'er sheva vayelech harona." Vayetze Yaakov mibe'er sheva vayelech harona. There's an obvious question here. An obvious question that Rashi's bothered by. Rashi doesn't say questions. Rashi rarely ever tells you what the question is. But whenever Rashi comments, there's a question. Where's Max Fruchter? Max? Who's going to be taking notes for this if Max's not here? You got it? Dave, you got it? You got it. Okay. So the obvious question is, what do you mean, Vayetze Yaakov Beersheva Vayelech Harana? First of all, it tells me Vayelech Harana. Why do you have to tell me he left? I'm going home at 10:30 tonight, going back to Beit Shemesh. So, but I'm going to tell my wife, no, I'm on my way to Beit Shemesh. I'm going to say, I left Yerushalayim and on my way to Beit Shemesh? Not necessary. Plus, add to the fact that at the end of last week's Parsha, Parsha's told us, it already told us that Yaakov left. He went, Vayelech Padan Aram. He left to go to Padan Aram. So why is it necessary for the Torah to tell me again, Vayetze Yaakov Miber Sheva? Why is it significant of where he left from, that he left? Significance that where he's going, not that he where he left from. Question number one. Question number two. What is the deal with all the dreams in this week's parasha? There are at least three, even more, if you read Rashi, but at least three in the text. Three dreams in the text. The parasha begins with dreams. What's the dream that it begins with?
Ladder.
He sees the sulam utzavarta. He sees the ladder. He sees the angels. And then there's a dream in the middle of the parasha when he speaks to Leah and Rachel, which we'll get to. And then there's a dream at the end of the parasha. Or a vision. He sees a vision of Malachim at the end of the parsha. So what is up with this parsha and dreams? Question number three. As was mentioned, Judah mentioned the ladder, Sulam Utsav Archa. And it says, Malachi Elokim Olim V'yardim Bo. The Malachim are going up and down this ladder. Says Rashi. Again, remember, Rashi only comments when there's a difficulty in the pasuk. Okay, that is the rule. Rashi says it actually in Parshas Vayeshev. He says that he only brings a Medrash Agada when there's a difficulty in the pasuk. So, what is the difficulty here? It says Malachei Elokim Olim V'yardim Bo. Rashi comments. Does anyone remember what Rashi says here?
Eretz Yisrael.
Okay, the Malachim of Eretz Yisrael going up. And the Malachim of Chutz La'aretz, they're going to get scored, Yaakov, they're coming down. Olim V'yardim Bo. What's the difficulty in the pasuk? That he has to bring this medrash? What do you say? No?
Why would
anything difficult here?
You should go down first. They should go down first. Oh, what do you say?
Malachim should come down first. Malachim should come down. Why is it Olim V'yardim Bo? Malachim should come down and then go up. Olim V'yardim Bo should be Yardim Bo Olim Bo. Malachim coming from heaven, heavenly beings coming should come down. It says Olim V'yardim Bo. Now the Rashbam, who's one of the classic Pashtanim, he rarely wants to use a Medrash, and he's also happens to be grandson of Rashi. He says, Lefi pshuto shel mikra, the simple reading is Olim V'yardim Bo means going up and down. And he says that's the Torah speaks in the language of man. The language of man is to say, what do you say when you're going up and down the ladder? What do you say? Up and down, excellent. You're going up and down the ladder, up and down. The whole day I'm going up and down the stairs, up and down the stairs. That's the language of man. Olim V'yardim Bo. There's no reason to go to the Medrash. There's no difficulty here. The Torah speaks the language of man. Olim V'yardim Bo. What exactly is the machlokis here between Rashi and the Rashbam? This is something you should ask yourself. When you're learning Chumash B'Iyud, and some of you have the opportunity to do it, you're finding, here he is. You'll get the first two questions from Bustowski. We'll give it to you. Anyways, Olimvi or Dimbo, what is the machlokas here in Rashi and Rashbam? Whenever you learn Chumash, you should ask yourself, if there's a machlokas in the Rishonim, the Mefarshim, what is the machlokas? Okay, that's question number two. Question number three.
Number three.
That was question number three. Thank you. Question number four. Hashem appears to him in the dream. He has this dream, he has a vision. Hashem appears to him in the dream. And Hashem assures Yaakov. He assures Yaakov, he says, Yaakov, this place where you're lying, this is the land I'm going to give you. So I promise you that I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak. I'm going to give this land to you and to your children. And you're going to grow. Ufaratza yamava kemet safan vanegba. You're going to be a blessed people. And I am going to watch over you. V'hinei anochi imcha, I'm with you. Shmarticha b'chol asher teleich. V'ashiv osicha l'adamazos. I'm going to return you to this land. Yaakov, I got your back. I've got your back. Okay? Yaakov wakes up and he says, wow, this place is awesome. Man no ra makom hazeh. I didn't realize that this is a Beis Elokim. I didn't realize how holy this place was. Had I known, I wouldn't have gone to sleep. Imagine that. He had this unbelievable vision in his dream, and had he known that he wouldn't have had that vision, he would say, I would forego, I wouldn't have gone to sleep. And then he makes a neder. And he makes a neder and he says, Hashem, if you're going to be with me, and you're going to watch over me, and you're going to take care of me, you're going to bring me back to this place, so then I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. Anyone see a difficulty here? Anyone bothered by anything over here?
Doesn't matter what Hashem's going to do. Doesn't matter what Hashem's going to do. I mean, either way, you should.
Okay. Before we get to that.
That's what I said.
Okay, that's what he said. We'll get to that in a second. But before that,
Hashem just told him he was going to be doing X, Y, and Z.
Excellent. Jonathan, beautiful. Hashem just told him, I'm going to take care of you. God speaking. It's not Olshem speaking. It's God speaking and telling him, don't worry. I have your back. I'm going to take care of you. You're covered. And then he cuts up and he says, Hashem, if you're going to do all these things that you tell, what are you worried about? Hashem just said he's going to do it. Why are you making this neder as if you're doubting Hashem? Only if you do this, that will convince Hashem to do it. Hashem said he's going to do it. What are you doubting Hashem? It looks like he's doubting God. And related to this question, we'll call it part of question 4 instead of question 5. As David and Eitan pointed out, is that what kind of t'nai is he making? What kind of condition is he making? It says like this. Vayidor Yaakov neder le'emor. Im Elokim adi. If God's with me, Shmarani b'derechim, watches over me, and he gives me lechem lechol, begel lebosh, food to eat and clothing to wear, v'shavti v'shom avi savi, and he'll return me to my father's house, v'haya Hashem li le'elokim, then you will be my God. Va'evan azos, and this rock that I'll make into a mizbeach, and I'll give you a tenth. Hashem will be your God if He does all these things for you. What is that? What is that all about? Ellie, with me?
Yeah.
So what is that all about? He's making a deal with God. God, you will be my God only if you do X, Y, and Z. He's a front runner. Only if you show me what you can do, then you'll be my God. Otherwise, you're not my God. Is that what Yaakov is saying? So those are the 4 questions. Excuse me. Okay. This parsha is called Vayetze. It's called Vayetze specifically. Torah didn't have to say Vayetze. It could have said, it already said in last week's parsha, could have just said Vayelach Harana. It's called Vayetze because it's this parsha. And it's really the only parsha of in its entirety until we go down to Mitzrayim that takes place in Chutz Laaretz. The whole parsha is about, and this many in the Mefarshim point out, later Mefarshim, like the Sfas Emes, the Beis Halevi, the Nesiva Shalom, that this parsha is the parsha about going to Chutz Laaretz. Yaakov is facing the challenge of leaving Eretz Yisrael. He's going into the Golos. And it's and it's bezchus. It's the through the merit of Yaakov, Maase Avot Siman LeBanim, how he is able to live up to the challenges of that he's going to face in Chutz La'aretz. That's what allows us a ability to survive and perhaps thrive in the Galut. So what he, how he's going to manage and face up to these challenges is very important for us. Because if we have the ability to do it, it's only because we are a descendant of Yaakov. It's built into our spiritual genes, what he's able to accomplish in this week's parsha. That's what's Vayetze Yaakov. It's about the going out of Israel. Now he's going to face some formidable challenges. And what he faced in Israel, guys, unless you're taking notes, please put them away. Unless, unless he's ready, and he has God's help, it's a challenge that maybe even Yaakov, someone as great as Yaakov, may be too difficult for him. Now let's remind ourselves, Yaakov, before leaving, even though his mother told him, go, get out, Esav wants to kill you, go find a wife from my family, go. Yaakov doesn't go straight away. And remember where Chazal tells us where Yaakov goes straight away? He went to yeshiva for a year. Went to yeshiva for a year and he stayed a second year, a third year, a fourth year. Parents are getting a little nervous, he's staying a little long, he's getting religious on them. He stays 14 years. 14 years in Shir Shem Eire. That's what Chazal say. And you have to explain where the 14 years, because Yaakov is 75 in the parsha when he gets married, 65. So this 14 years, which Chazal say, he was sitting and learning Shir Shem Eire. What they were learning Shir Shem Eire exactly? A topic for another shir. If you're interested in that issue, I'm happy to share it with you a different time. So he comes from the house of grandfather Avram, his father Yitzchak, mother Rivka, grandmother Sarah, spends 14 years Shem Be'aver, and he's still nervous about leaving Eretz Yisrael and going, facing the big, bad, secular world. So even after Hashem promises him, don't worry, Yaakov. I'm going to take care of you. He sees this vision. He sees the Malachim Olim V'Yordim Bo. So what's the Machlokas between Rashi and Ramban? Now whenever you have a Machlokas, and this applies, in Chumash implies, when you're learning in the Gemara, you have a Machlokas Rishonim. So what should you do? I'm talking about methodology. Okay, methodologically, what should you be doing? When you have a machlokes, you want to try to understand what are they arguing about. So what you should do is actually the we're just learning the daf. Those learning the daf, Josh can tell you, in Shkolim, in Sagar Shkolim, there was a number of machlokesim, and they actually did this exact exercise in the Gemara, not outside, in the Gemara. They understood one opinion. They said, okay, if that opinion makes sense to us, what could the other opinion possibly be holding? That's what you want to ask yourself. Which one makes more sense to you? I ask you, which one makes more sense, Rashi or the Rashba? I'll remind you what they said. Rashi saw a difficulty in the phrase Olim V'Yordimbo. It should be Yordimbo Olimbo. We're dealing with heavenly angels. They should be coming down, going, and then going up. It should be Yordimbo Olimbo. Says the Rashba, there's no difficulty here. That's the Torah speaks in the language of man. And the language of man is, you go up and down. Up and down. You go up and down, it's a ladder, no matter where you're starting from. Even if you live on the third floor. You live on the third floor, right? Somebody here live on the third floor. So, if you're going to visit your friends on the first floor, and then you're at, I'm just going up and down the stairs all the time. You don't think, like, oh, where I started from the third floor, so I'm actually going down and up. No, you say up and down. So, who makes more sense? The Rashbam, right? The Rashbam makes more sense. So if the Rashbam makes more sense, so then the next question is, that's question number one. Question number two is, then what is Rashi thinking? If he makes more sense, logically makes more sense, so what in the world is Rashi thinking? That's question number two you have to ask yourself. So what would you say? Why does Rashi, again, part of the assumption here is, and this is an assumption you should make whenever there's a machlokas Rishonim or machlokas in the Gemara, is that they know, they understand the logic of the other. Whereas Rashi understood the language of man is only in the Yardimbo, is going up and down. Despite that, Rashi still felt there's a difficulty here. Why? What could be the svara why Rashi said there's a difficulty here and he has to bring this medrash? Don't be nervous. It's just we're recording this for just yeah.
Well, if they go up first before they come down, then there'll be a point where he doesn't have angels.
Okay, but you're reading it to the Medrash. What I mean is there a difficulty in saying that in the Pasuk? In the Pasuk he's saying you see angels going up and down a ladder. Even though where their starting point may be up. Maybe?
Because he has an answer which is more logical than what the Rashi said.
But again, it may be so, but the question is, he's quoting the Medrash. Why is he see there's a difficulty in the Pasuk before? Okay, so, yeah, Sammy.
Maybe, why would they be going up and down? Why would they be going up and down on the same ladder in the same place?
Okay, possibly. I would say as follows. I would say two possible things that Rashi is bothered by. First of all, yes, it's true that the Torah speaks in language of man. But we're not talking about men here. We're talking about angels. The Torah says they're angels. It doesn't say they're men. And when you're talking about angels, since you're talking about angels, it doesn't make sense to talk about the language of man. Use the language that the angels use. The angels would probably, talking with each other, they would say, right? They would say going down and up. Because from the perspective of angels, that's their starting point. We, the language of man, starts with up and down because we start on the ground and we go up. Whenever we go up a ladder, this is where we're starting. We're starting down. But angels start up. So their language, the language of angels, we're talking about angels, would be down and up. But I think the better reason is that we're dealing with a dream here. What's being described is a dream. Now, when you have a dream, you have a crazy dream, right? So, you have a crazy dream and you're telling it over to your friend, which may or may not be a good idea. But you're going to tell over, you know, you don't always remember all the facts, but you're going to tell over exactly as it happened. Even though there's crazy stuff in the dream, dreams don't make sense. You're going to tell it over. If you see angels going up and down, you're going to say it up and down. If they're going down and up, you're going to say first they're going down, then they're going up. You want to be exact as possible. It says that you want help interpreting the dream. So you can give these crazy things. Like the time I had a dream that I was being fed these light and fluffy marshmallows by a tall, dark, and beautiful tree. You know, like from Lord of the Rings? One of those dwarf trees. And then I woke up and I couldn't find my pillow. It's crazy dreams. You want to get exactly what happened. You have to give exact details. So we're dealing with a dream. We're dealing with a dream. The details are so important. You're not going to just use euphemisms. You're going to say it exactly as it happened. So Rashi tells us, and what's important is the message. The next thing you want to do is when Rashi, after you learn that Rashi carefully, is what's the message of the Medrash? What is the Medrash trying to teach us here? And clearly what it's trying to teach us is that there's a different shmirah that you need. There's a type of shmirah, a type of protection that Yaakov needs when he's in Eretz Israel. And now those angels that protected him in Israel, they're going up. their service is no longer needed or no longer helpful. We need new angels. You're going to hell. You need hell's angels now coming down. Okay? To go to Chutz La'aretz. You need a new protection. So you see, Yaakov is worried. Yes, it's true. Although, by the way, the question of why does Yaakov have to ask God for these things if he was just promised them in the dream? He wakes up and says, God, do all these things for me that you promised me and then I'll do this. Why does he have to do that? So there actually is one of the Mefarshim in the Medrash, this is like Derech Agav, one of the Mefarshim in the Medrash, in Bereishis Rabbah, Parsha Ayin, says, Mikra Misurasi, Misuresati. The Pasuk, the Parsha is actually written not in the correct order. Daniel, you with me? It's written not in the correct order. Meaning, really what happened, historically, chronologically, what happened was, is that first Yaakov made the neder. And then he had the dream, and Hashem promised him, just as you asked, so it will be. So then that solves that difficulty. The question you have to ask then is, why did the Torah not write in that order? It's a good question. But that's one manda amar in that medrash. The other manda amar says, no, as the Torah wrote it, that's how it happened. So then why did Yaakov feel a need to ask God for all these things after Hashem promised it's going to happen? Perhaps the answer is, similar to what the Ramban says in next week's Parsha, of Shema Yigrom HaChet, is that Yaakov's word, yeah, Hashem's making me these promises now, before I'm in Beit El. Man, this is a holy place. I've been living my whole life in the house of Avram and Yitzchak. I've been sitting in the yeshiva Shem Ve'Ever, but I'm about to go to Chutz La'aretz. I'm about to go into the unknown, to this dangerous place that they've been telling me about in yeshiva. Don't leave yeshiva if you know what's out there. Are you crazy? I'm about to go there, and maybe I'm gonna fall. Maybe I'm not going to be the same Yaakov that I was, that I am now. And what he's asking Hashem, and I'm going to go through it now, what he's asking Hashem is, protect me, not only physically protect me, not only provide me with food, but protect me spiritually. I'm afraid of going to Chutz La'aretz, and maybe going to Chutz La'aretz, I'm going to crash, and I won't be deserving of what you're promising me now, because now I'm Yaakov. But who knows what will become of me when I go to Chutz La'aretz? Maybe I won't be deserving of it then. That's what Yaakov's neder is about. Now, Rav Soloveitchik, 20 years ago, I just found my notebook from 20 years ago. Max, if you want to have a look at it, it's over here. 20 years ago, when I was actually in the Kollel at the time, and I was teaching in a school at nights, I was substituting for a while in a girls' school, and I actually gave this shiur 20 years ago. And I had seen the notes from one of my friend of mine who was in the kollel here. His grandfather was in Rav Soloveitchik's shiur in 1942. And he had notes from that shiur that Rav Soloveitchik gave on Vayetre. And I read his notes, and this is the next part is from Rav Soloveitchik, 1942. And it's unbelievable. The next part is like one of the most unbelievable Divrei Torah you'll ever hear in the next 5 years. But Soloveitchik said Yaakov's neder, Yaakov's tefillah, was he was concerned about three things. Okay? Three things. And it's the fear that every person going out to an immigrant, going out to a new country, it's the fear that he has. He says, Vayidar Yaakov neder leimor, im yelokim adi ushmarani baderech hazeh. Number one. Im yelokim adi ushmarani baderech hazeh. A person is concerned about going to a foreign country. A stranger doesn't have that sense of security. Okay? Some of you, at the end of the year, you're going to travel. You do some traveling. Every year, there's a few guys that do it. travel to some European country you've never been to, right? And your parents will say to you, get a money belt. You know, to protect your passport so you can keep under your, you know, under your belt and under your, you know, under your clothing. You know, because you never know, in these foreign countries you get pickpocketed, they see an American, they're gonna steal from you, pickpocket you. Right? Every American has this fear. Not only American, English people as well. They have this fear, they go to a foreign country, whatever it is, you don't know, their sense of security is compromised. Even you come to Israel, you don't have that sense of same security that you have. Alright, if you visit Australia, maybe you're not worried. Unless you go to the Outback. But in general, you go to a foreign place, people are scared and nervous. Now the Jew, all the more so. The Jew traveling to a foreign country, so he feels he's nervous about anti-Semitism. You'll put on a hat, not a black one, baseball cap, right? So they shouldn't think you're Jewish, right? When did that ever work? You know, they know you a mile away. They know us. I remember one time I went to a Met game. It was in June. It was many years ago, and there was. So I went wearing, you know, looking like everybody else, wearing a Met baseball cap. But they know you. They smell you. They know you're Jewish. There's nothing you can do about it. Nothing you can do. And at that time there was a terrible scandal that there was in the yeshiva Flatbush, actually, was one of them, was involved in buying the regents. It was on the front page of New York Post. It's about 20 some odd years ago. That they had got their hands on the regents, they paid money, whatever, without, and it was like on the front page. So, you know, I'm here at the baseball game pretending I'm like, you know, regular non-Jew like everybody else. I'm like, at least five people came over to goes, hey, you got the regents? You want to sell me the regents? You want to sell me the regents? Hey, what are you going to wear? Come on. You know? Give me a beer, you know? They don't buy it. It doesn't work. So, as a Jew in a foreign country, we're scared, we're nervous, I hope they don't know I'm Jewish. Because we're susceptible. We know we're a target. And this is what Yaakov's fear was. He's going out. And we've been pushed around. Let's face it. We've been pushed around wherever we've been, whatever country we've been to. Whether it was Spain, or England, or Eastern Europe, or Arabic countries. We've been pushed out, pushed around. The only place that we can feel secure is here in Israel. Now, you may be like the chassid I met a couple years ago when I was in Poland. I was waiting in the airport in Warsaw. I was waiting for a group to arrive from England. And this chassid guy comes over to me. He sees another Jew in the thing. I don't know how he figured it out. But he comes over to me talking. And he says, where are you from? Eretz Israel. Ah, Eretz Israel. Such a... You know, such a difficult place to live. I said, you know, where are you from? He goes, I'm from Borough Park. Oh, great. Aren't you scared to live in Israel? I said, what? In Borough Park, you're okay? There's no fear in Borough Park? No, it's the worst thing to have in Jewish people is the state of Israel. I said, really? So yeah, we were much better off before we had the state of Israel. I said, we're in Warsaw? You telling me this in Warsaw? You know how many Jews are left here in Poland? There used to be 3 million Jews here. There's now maybe 10,000 Jews in Warsaw, and most of them are here just because their groups coming to visit to see the death camps. And you're telling me we're better off before the state of Israel? Are you serious? So maybe you're of that mindset. I don't know, we can have this discussion later. But we've been pushed around when we go to Chatzaris. And that's a fear that every Jew has. That's Shmarani Baderech. Protect me. Physically, physical protection. Number two. V'nasan li lechem le'achol abegel abosh. Im yelukim adim shmarani baderech hazeh asher anuchi olek v'nasan lechem le'achol abegel abosh. The next concern a Jew has when he goes to a foreign country, not only a Jew, but any person going to a foreign country, is the fear of, am I going to be able to make a living? Right? When you are an immigrant, and you have to start worrying about making a living in a place that you can't speak the language, you don't know the culture, you don't know the right people, that's a real fear. That's a real fear. You see it here with the Russian immigrants here in Israel. We have hundreds of thousands of immigrants from Russia over the last 20 years. And although they're Jews, most of them, they came here, they don't speak the language, they don't understand the culture. And you have people who are very highly educated working in menial jobs. They couldn't find jobs. We had a cleaner in our house, this woman cleaner. When she was in Russia, she was a rocket scientist. Which just goes to prove you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be a rocket scientist. Because she wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. But one time we had to fire her, actually, because we sort of noticed that she was tying hundreds of helium balloons to the house. And I caught it just in time. The good thing was that I was able to do imitations of Alvin and Chipmunks for my kids for a few weeks. But anyway, so you have people who are highly educated who couldn't find jobs. Can't find jobs in this new country. But for a Jew, it's much more difficult. And this is what Yaakov is really asking. This is what he's davening for, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, help me be able to find the Parnassa. And again, this is Rav Soloveitchik, circa 1942. Help me find the Parnassa without having to sacrifice my commitment to you, to God, and to your Torah. And this was not a simple thing. And it's not a simple thing. Today, it seems like it's not so difficult, but in 1940s, and to that generation that preceded it, the generation that came to America in the turn of the century, okay, and they came from Europe and from other countries, and they came because they saw there was a gold in Medina, there was a chance to get out of the oppression of Europe, and they went to America, and then when they arrived in America, they realized that in order to make a living, you have to work on Shabbos. There was no such thing as a weekend. You worked 7 days, 7 days a week. Maybe they gave you off Sunday. That was it. Sunday was off, 6 days a week you worked. Everybody worked on Shabbos. So what are you supposed to do? You're an immigrant, a Jew, coming from the old country. You arrive in America, you need to make a parnassa. You have a living, you don't have nothing with you. And then if you got a job, if you're lucky enough to get a job, you had a choice. Either you're Mechal Shabbat, or you get fired come Monday. You didn't show up to work for Saturday, you don't have a place to come back on Monday. And people had to make that choice, and it was a very, very difficult choice. I'm sure you all, I'm not telling you anything new, you've all heard these stories. They were true. Some of you come from families whose great-grandparents refused to work on Shabbat. I would venture to guess that most of you come from those kind of families. Because most of the families who worked on Shabbat, and again, we can't judge them because they were afraid they wouldn't be able to put food on the table. Maybe they were arguing with pikuach nefesh. There were ways to rationalize it. Again, it's very easy for us to judge 100 years later. But those families who stuck it out, who somehow managed to find a job with a Jew or peddled something of their own, and somehow managed to get a living with tremendous mesirut nefesh for God and Torah, probably most of us come from those people. And the others who worked on Shabbat, So it's likely, it could be there's some of us are from them as well, but it's likely that most of them are not spending the year in Israel. Most of them are not have any have no connection anymore. Generations, four or five generations removed, have no longer a connection. Some of us may come from families that at some point one of those generations came back to Judaism, came back to observant life. But that was the great, that's the great challenge. Can I earn a living and remain true in keeping Torah mitzvahs? I was talking earlier with Avi Ohayon that the conservative movement, the entire conservative movement is a grassroots movement that began in America at this time in our history. Because you had people who came from traditional homes, meaning religious homes in Europe, and they came, whether it was from Germany or from Eastern Europe, and they came and they saw they had to make a choice and they had to make a sacrifice. And they sacrificed religion on some level. They sacrificed Shabbat or other things, kashrut, whatever it was. But they still wanted to remain connected. So the conservative movement basically was this compromise movement, saying, okay, you can still be connected, even though you're not keeping Shabbat, it's okay. You're not giving kashrut exactly, it's okay, we'll figure it out. Figure it out. And they came up with Shiloh to Tshuvot, quoting the sources, not the sources that Rav Avadya has, Yabia Omer necessarily, but using and coming up with a way to say, okay, you can drive to Shul on Shabbat and still, it's okay. That's how the movement developed. It did not start. Reform movement just started in Europe, in a place called Pittsburgh, in Germany. But the conservative movement started to try to, you know, as a movement of compromise. This is what the people were doing anyways. Let's try to bring them in. But those who remained steadfast, even though they thought Orthodoxy was going to be dead in a few years. There's a famous video of the Munkacher Rebbe. Some of you may have seen this. There's a well-known family, the Teichman family in Los Angeles, who they're Mr. Teichman. Was Saul Teichman was at this wedding in Munkacs. He grew up in Munkacs. I think I believe it's from 1930, 1933. And it's a video, you can see it on, it's go on YouTube, you see the video. It's the Munkacs Rebbe sitting in a wagon and back of one of these old cars. And he's crying, yelling to my breeder in America, to my brothers in America, to keep Shabbos, keep Shabbos. That was the great challenge. Don't forget about Shabbos. Because most people weren't. They gave up on it. So this is can I be religious still and still earn a living? Respectable, put food on the table for my family. Finally, the last thing Yaakov requests, and this is the most significant. What else is there? So Yaakov says, "Vishavti v'shalom leis avi." Let me return in peace to my father's house. Says Rashi, "Shalom, shalem min hachet, shlo elmad midarkei lavan." I should be whole, shlemos, shalem min hachet, shlo elmad midarkei lavan. Yaakov is asking, please, okay, I want to be safe, secure, no anti-Semitism. I want to be able to earn a living without having to sacrifice Torah and Mitzvah. And then the third thing is that I don't want to be influenced from the ways of Lavan. I'm afraid of the surrounding culture, how it's going to affect me. And we're all affected by our surrounding culture. Everybody. Even people that are not immigrants. But wherever we are, we come from Los Angeles. You see, there's a certain thing about LA guys, there's a certain thing about them. Some of them are not here right now. Okay? they're influenced by the surroundings. All of us are influenced by our surroundings. Wherever we come from, we have certain influences. Those of us who come from America, we're influenced by the pervasive culture of America. But as an immigrant, you tend to be much more influenced by the surrounding culture. Because you have a desperate need to try to fit in. You don't want to be noticed. You want to fit in. You want people to like you. Okay, maybe you, those of you, where's Jake Leibovich? Okay, there is those of you who have had the experience of moving when you know, from the age of 5 till 16, 17. Moving from one neighborhood to another, from one city to another, starting a new school. Okay? It's a traumatic experience. It's one of the most stressful experiences a person can have. When I was 10 years old, my family moved from Queens to the Five Towns.
Really?
That's intimidating. Queens boy to go to the Five Towns, right? We're the DRS guys. You know what I'm talking about? Right? To go, right? All the guys from YCQ and Hartora to go to DRS. It's very intimidating. That's what I did. I went from Dove Revel, doesn't exist anymore, to HALP, fifth grade. My parents were very kind to me. They did it in the middle of the year, November, like right around this time of year, 24 years ago, 34 years ago. 34 years ago, I was 10 years old. I've gotten over it. I will twitch from it, but otherwise... Anyways, the guys who I was most intimidated of, the guys warned me. Like, I had this one kid who was in first grade with me, and he had moved a few years before me, and he said, "Oh, watch out for these four guys. You want to stay away from them." They ended up being my best friends, but it's a very traumatic experience. You want to fit in. You want people like you. So you try to be more like them than they are like themselves. Yaakov doesn't want to be influenced by his surroundings. And as I said, we are all influenced. We are all influenced. There is, when I was here in the Kollel, tell this story very quickly. When I was here in the Kollel, so there was a guy here, his name was Rabbi Carey Friedman, now he's Rabbi Carey Friedman. Before then, he was just known as Carey Friedman. He's written a few books, actually. He now works for the FBI and for other interesting places. But he was somebody who was older than most of us though in the call. He already was married with four kids. And he had worked professionally as an engineer, and he told us a story about being influenced by your surroundings. He was working in this office in, I believe it was in Connecticut, and across the street from the office was a place called Mrs. Pips, which was like a Hooters type of establishment. Okay, if you don't know what I'm talking about, good for you. Anyway, so They had lunch break in their office from 11:30 to 12:15 was lunch break, and at about 11 o'clock, the whole office, like it was not a big office, 25 people in the office, the whole office would clear out and go across the lunch to Mrs. Pips at like 11 o'clock. Lunch break was officially 11:30 to 12:15, and they would come back. Wobble back into the store, into the office about 1 o'clock to get back to work. Now the guy who was in, whatever the boss was in charge of the office, he was rarely there on site. This was like a satellite of the main office was in the city. But basically the whole place packed out. So now he was like he had been to yeshiva. He was like he became frum and he was so, but and he knew that. The halacha is that your lunch break is that's when you're supposed to take a break. Otherwise, you're supposed to be working till So he, you know, everyone left, and he stayed in the office, and he worked till 11:30, and then 11:30 came, and he took out his lunch, and he ate lunch, 12:15, and went back to work. But, you know, as this continued day in, day out, he said, "This is ridiculous. I'm gonna continue working." Now, he wasn't going to go to Mrs. Phipps. That he had a red line. You know, he wasn't going there, but I might as well learn. From 11 o'clock, I might as well open a safer. And so he did. He learned from 11 till 1. Great. It was wonderful. And he told his Rebbe, again, he was just a number of years that he had been observant. He told his Rebbe, "I have this great job. Everyone goes out to this thing. And I'm learning for 2 hours, you know, during." And Rebbe said to him, "You see how you've been influenced by your surroundings?" He said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? I'm learning for 2 hours there in Mrs. Phipps." He said, "No, but you have stolen from your company. From 11 to 11:30, you're learning, but you should be working. From 12:15 to 1, you're learning, very nice, but you should be working. You have no right to learn during that time. You should be working." And he's like, "Wow, I didn't like. You see how you're influenced." So we're all on some level we're influenced, all of us. And I could spend the rest of the night here just going different examples of how Western society, American Western society, is pervasively changed our worldview on certain issues. And if you want, we could talk about these issues at length. But I'll just throw out one issue. It's a very, very sensitive topic, and it deserves a long discussion, not for now. But something that has changed. When we started yeshiva 13 years ago, this was not the case. But today it's the case. I would venture to say that more than 50% of you support gay marriage. You don't see any problem with it. I'm not a homosexual. I just, you know, they should be able to do whatever they want to do. It's their, not my business. I support gay marriage. Now, to even in some certain places, even to say how could you support gay marriage, you would be shut down. How can you even say that? You're a homophobe, you're racist, you're this, you're that. You can't even raise the issue in some places. But 15 years ago, 12, 13 years ago, if I posed that question to 12 guys in Torah Shraga, 8 of them, 9 of them, 10 of them would have said, "Of course we're opposed to gay marriage." But today, again, I'm not asking for hands, but today I would say 50, 60% of this room is probably saying, "I don't see any problem with it. I'm happy to hear what you have to say, Rabbi. I'm happy to debate it with you, but I don't see any problem with it." And that is the culture that we live in has pervaded our sense of approach. It's a fact. It's a fact that has happened in the Jewish in the Jewish circles that we move in. We have changed. We have shifted this. Whether you say it's good or bad, that is a fact. This is what Yaakov was so worried about. Worried about being influenced by the surrounding culture. And now here is the amazing part. Listen to what Rav Soloveitchik, his mom's brilliant, brilliant thing that he pointed out. Remember, one of the questions, we've answered almost all the questions except for one thing we haven't really spoken about. And that is the dreams. There's a second dream of the Parsha. And with this we'll close. There's a second dream in the parasha, and that's when, after spending 20 years in the house of Lavan, 20 years in the house of Lavan, Yaakov has 4 wives, 12 kids, and a lot of sheep. Okay, he's a wealthy man. He's got a beautiful family, and he calls out Leah and Rachel and tells them to come out to the field. He wants to speak to them privately. He brings them out to the field, and he says to them, it's time to go back. 20 years have passed. Now again, Yaakov, he's in his 60s, 70s, He's an adult. You know, he's now he's much older. He's in the 80s. He's an adult. He has wives. He has, after spending years studying yeshiva, he comes to Leah Noach and he says as follows. V'asaynai v'erebe chalom v'hinei ha'atudim ha'olim alatzon akudim nekudim v'brudim. He says, I lifted my eyes and I saw in a dream. What does he see in a dream? He sees the bespeckled, dotted, sparkled sheep. However you want to interpret it, akudim, rudim, nekudim. He sees sheep. That's what he sees in his dream. Vayomer Eli Malach Hashem, Malach Elokim b'chalom, Yaakov v'omer hineni. So the Malach of God calls out to him, he says, Yaakov. And he says, here I am. And he says to him, Vayomer, sana inecha, urei, kol atudim, haolim alatzom, akudim nekudim v'rudim, ki ra'isi es kol asher lavan oselach. Unbelievable. Soloveitchik says, and it's Hashem Shah. The Malach says to him, what do you see in your dream? What did you see in your dream? You see all the tzom, all the sheep that you've been working on for the last 20 years. That's what you see in your dreams. You know, Yaakov, 20 years ago, when you had that dream, the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, what did you see? You saw the Malachei Elokim, Olim v'Yodim bo. You saw images of angels of God. You saw images of spirituality. Now what do you see in your dreams? You see physicality. You see the tzon. You see the material world. That's what you're dreaming about now? Ra'isi es kol asher levan oselecha. I see what Lavan has done to you. Your dreams have changed. You used to dream about spiritual things. Now you're dreaming. Joe and Ray, talk about this back in the room. Now you're dreaming about physical, material wealth. I see what Lavan has done to you. It's time to go back. You better get out of here. It's time to go home. And at the end of the parsha, he sees, once again, he sees the angels. He sees the angels, and now the angels that are coming to greet him, they're the ones going up, and now a new set of angels is about to enter, so a new set of angels are coming to greet him. That's the end of the parsha. That's how the parsha closes, just as it began. Vayakov halach ledarko vayefku bo malachei Elokim. Vayom Yaakov kasher ra'a machanei Elokim zeh vayekroshin makom u'machanayim. Says Rashi, Shtei machanot shel chutz la'aretz shebo imo adkan v'shel Eretz Yisrael shebo lekarto. There were two camps. There was the camp of the angels that escorted him till now. Now there's a new camp of angels taking him to Eretz Yisrael. My friends, when your dreams change, that means that the surrounding culture has had an influence. It's time to go back. What we dream about, what we wish for, this goes back to something we spoke about earlier in the year. The things that we can only dream about, that's really who we are. And Yaakov, when his dreams changed, that was it. That was, even though he was Yaakov, he as the next week's parasha, Tire of Mitzvah Shamarti, I kept all the 630 mitzvahs in the house of Lavan. I didn't compromise on that at all. But what were the things that I wished for? What were the things that I wanted to become? One of the things that you have to realize when you're during your year in Israel is that the dreams, and I tried to bring it out, I don't know how many of you caught on when we had the Shabbaton in Beit Shemesh. The dreams of people like yourselves, living 18 years in Chutz La'aretz, are different than the dreams of people, even like yourselves. Nothing about in the Haredi world. I'm talking about people who have the same access, the same smartphones and internet and sometimes TV and so on. But they dream. Their dreams are different dreams. What they aspire to, what they want to be, how they want to contribute, are different. Now you can, this opportunity, this year gives you the opportunity to some of us to change our dreams. In the sense of, maybe till now, I just want to make as much money as I can. To, I want to make a difference in the world in the sense of giving to others. Being about chesed. Maybe I wanted to be, I still want to be a doctor, it hasn't changed, but Obamacare has changed it. You know, once I could be a wealthy doctor, now I can't be a wealthy doctor anymore. But I want to be a doctor because I want to give to others. I see someone like Rabbi Apfel, I say, I want to be like him. Wow, like, look, he's kulo chesed, he's all chesed. He takes no money for all the doctoring he does here in this country. It's unbelievable. I want to be like that. I want to give to the Jewish people. I want to make a difference. I want to help others. I want to be a Talmid Chacham. We heard today that unbelievable speech from Rabbi Dweck. I want to maximize my time in this world, doing something meaningful. Those are the dreams that I wish I had. And when those dreams start to change, and a lot of us have dreams when we have our year in Israel, and then now this is more to the Shana Bekka. When you go back, some of them are going in a few weeks from now, and you go back, and then you start seeing that things that were my dreams just a few weeks ago are starting to change. You realize that is it's a red alert. It's hard to recharge. Doesn't mean you have to come back to Israel necessarily. But it's not a bad idea. It means I gotta get perspective again. I have to reconnect.
Have a good evening.
I want to tell you what I was going to tell you. I mean to tell you this like 3 days ago.
What?